Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:04 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time, and today is January 8th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And there really is a lot to talk about this week because we've had a lot of extremely meaningful moves, but perhaps the most important of those is the fact that 10-year treasuries are back above the 1% level, and this is meaningful. And I think the exact meaning is probably going to have knock-on effects for the foreseeable future. But so far, they're not particularly evident, other than the fact that the dollar is starting to rally and gold pulled back rather sharply in here today. We can also see that the yield had compressed very significantly from that initial break above 3% in late 2018. That was one of the causal factors in the very significant moves by the Federal Reserve to give up on quantitative tightening and to start cutting rates, boosting liquidity. And it really went into overdrive during the pandemic period at the first quarter of 2020. So we've seen yields compress from 3.25 down to less than 50 basis points in the space of about 15 months. And that's a profound move by any stretch of the imagination, but it's now being unwound. So there's a big question. Some people will be looking at that area of previous support as a potential area of resistance at around 1.5%. So the yield today is at 1.11, and another 40-odd basis points will take it back to the 1.5% level. The major idiosyncrasy of 2020 has been that despite the fact yields have, or I guess despite the fact that the quantity of debt has multiplied outstanding, the yield has compressed so quickly that the overall funding costs for governments has in fact contracted. And that is something that has been really very beneficial. If we think about the fact that the German government has got its entire yield curve in negative territory, so they can borrow as much money as they want, and they've been doing that. They've been massively boosting the amount of debt outstanding, and they've been pouring it into the economy, so that Germany's economy has been relatively well insulated from the ravages of the pandemic and the lockdowns, simply because the German government has had the opportunity afforded to it to borrow at negative rates. And then because they have increased their debt at negative rates, it means that the total cost of servicing the debt has in fact contracted over that exact same period of time, which makes the balance sheet look all the more attractive. It's been exactly the same thing for the UK. When we think about the gilt yield, it came down to extraordinarily low levels. And when we then just simply look at the chart and try to appraise ourselves of just how profound the contraction in yields has been, coming from 1.75 down to just about zero, although not quite zero, and then subsequently the base formation since the lows in March, well, that has also been a very significant factor in the ability of the UK government to massively increase the amount of stimulus that it can pour into the market. But all of these measures that have been deployed to try and support economies, they've resulted in a very significant increase in the total amount of debt overall, and that has, I think, in many respects been masked by the fact that the servicing costs of the debt have compressed. It all makes it look really very easy to handle. And it is easy to handle as long as these yields stay low. But we have a very different scenario if those yields rise. And it's not like governments are suddenly going to stop borrowing. In fact, the vast majority of governments around the world have committed themselves to doing whatever is necessary to fund reflation. That's as true in the USA as it is in Europe or Japan or China or just about everywhere else. India, for example, is looking at running a massive deficit. I think it's one of the most the largest deficits on record, in order to fund the reflation of the economy. And of course, as long as interest rates stay down, then that wouldn't be really beyond the bounds of possibility. But what we're in fact seeing is greater evidence of the selling pressure starting to come through in government bonds all over the world. We have base formations that are being completed in the USA and in Australia, less evidence of that in the UK. When we then think about the New Zealand market, it's been one of the economies that was best insulated from the coronavirus, and yet yields are pushing up in here. In fact, one of the only countries anywhere where yields are compressing is China, and the yield has been pulling back in and to unwind at this short-term overextension relative to the trend mean over the last 3 weeks. But then, of course, we have to look at the nominal rates as well, and the relative attraction of a yield in excess of 3% in a strengthening currency relative to the risible yields that are on offer from the vast majority of developed markets. Well, is it any wonder that people might want to pick up some of those Chinese bonds and capture that yield? Obviously, as we look at what is likely with the base formation completion on 10-year treasuries, then it's going to inevitably result in higher servicing costs on the debt. And then you had President-elect Joe Biden today talking about trillions of dollars in additional fiscal measures this year. Now, it's all well and good to talk about them. It's another thing to get them passed. The Democrats have now got control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency, although the Senate by the slimmest of possible margins. So they're going to need unanimity in order to get some of their more ambitious projects passed, and that's not a certainty. Although it does look like it is more of a certainty than it did before the runoff election in Georgia this week. So we're definitely likely to have some form of additional fiscal spending this year, and the USA is looking at a $2 trillion deficit at a minimum this year. And then the question is, how are they going to convince anybody to buy their bonds when the yield is only around 1% and you can get 3% in China? Well, the Fed is obviously then going to have to play a part. And this is where the whole argument about yield curve control comes in, because the yield curve is rising. And this is also one of the most important factors. It's up to now 100 basis points. Now, let's just go back and look at history and think about what happened on previous occasions when it goes inverted and then subsequently rebounds through the 75 basis point level. Because back in the early 2000s, it was sharply inverted. And as it cruised through the 75 basis point level in early 2000, and or excuse me, as it pushed through in 2001, then that's when we had some of the biggest declines in the stock market. As we think about the push back above 1%, or excuse me, 0% in 2007, and then as it pushed back and up through the 50 basis point level in late 2007, well, then it was after that we saw some of the deepest pullbacks in the stock market. Now, as we look at this scenario, if we're in a scenario like 1998, which was a shock in terms of the Russian debt default, then the collapse of long-term capital management, it resulted in very significant monetary accommodation, and it spurred the bubbly activity in the technology, media, and telecoms companies, and extraordinary mania in retail trading. But that whole episode forced the yield curve to stay low. And what we're seeing right now is a very clear steepening of the curve. So we're at the point now where the Federal Reserve is unlikely to do anything to try and arrest the steepening of the curve until they have to. And the stock market isn't pulling back. In fact, the stock market was at a new all-time high today. So it is really unlikely that the Federal Reserve is going to do anything as long as that remains the case, because why would they? Then if they were to try and assist the market in any way at all, well, then they would definitely be accused of inflating a bubble. The NASDAQ 100 broke successfully back above the 13,000 level in here today. Excuse me, not for the first time, broke above 13,000 today. So that has now clearly reasserted on the upside. So this is clear evidence of a return to demand dominance. And until we see evidence that there is weakness coming through in the stock market, then it's unlikely that the Federal Reserve is going to do very much to really intervene. But the higher bond yields go, the greater the risk it poses to the equity markets. And this, of course, is where the big questions reside, because the higher those yields go, the more risk there is that it's going to result in a problem in terms of liquidity. But we don't have evidence of it just yet. And until we have evidence of it, well, then the Federal Reserve is not going to act. And yield, the high yield spread, for example, is down now to the lows that that were evident in 2017 and 18 at less than 400 basis points, testing the 300 basis point level. When we think about financial conditions, it's looking very similar. And it does help if you spell on Bloomberg the correct words. If we think about the financial conditions chart, it looks identical to the high yield spread, other than the fact that it has been coming down even more aggressively, and it's still trending lower. So if we have got tightening high yield spreads and increasingly abundant financial conditions and loose financial conditions, then that offers ample scope for risk assets to continue to rally. And that's exactly what we're seeing on Wall Street, with the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 both pushing on to new high ground in here today. The market that has done best over the last couple of months since the election is the Russell 2000, and it has paused a little in here today, and it is overbought in the short term. I do find it interesting, though, that the Russell 2000 looks like the financial conditions index in inverse. So we can definitely think that the continued supply of liquidity has been a very significant factor in the outperformance of the Russell. But now we can also start to think about all of the bearish prognostications that we've had this week, because I've seen reports from Jeremy Grantham saying that this is very clearly a bubble. I've seen Fred Hickey quoted saying that this is an egregious bubble and that it is exactly the same as what we saw in the late 1990s. Albert Edwards, who's an historically bearish prognosticator, and his former colleague Ed Ballston, they've both also been very clear in stating that this run-up in yields is lighting the fuse on the end of this bubble. And then when we think about what valuations are like, well, I did provide, or I produced this list of price-to-sales ratios. Microsoft is trading on a price-to-sales ratio of 11. Tesla is at 28. Shopify is at 57. Zoom Communications is at 49. So this is just a handy way of thinking about the fact that we have got some really very ambitious valuations on a significant number of shares, because there's 150 odd number of shares on this list, and every one of them has a market cap of more than 10 billion. Well, it's not so long ago that 10 million or excuse me, 10 billion was considered to be on the cusp of large cap. Well, these days, it's barely a mid cap. So we've had massive asset price inflation over the course of the last 12 years. And a lot of it is predicated on extraordinarily low interest rates, abundant liquidity, and that condition persisting indefinitely. And with financial conditions where they are, with high yield spreads where they are, and with the promise of significant additional spending, well, then it's hard to imagine why the bubble might pop. In fact, what we have instead is continued very steep advances. And the one nice thing about monitoring accelerations is it's really easy. Obviously, if one is involved in the monitoring of these types of moves, then one is always going to question, when will they eventually peak? Well, the nice thing is that when we are looking at point and figure charts, then it really is very easy, because we can simply admire the incredible persistence of the move, and when it eventually stops, well, then we get a reversal. So if we just look at the daily chart for Tesla, it has been rallying with a series of ranges one above another, and the size of the ranges recently have been reasonably similar, of about a reaction of 4 units of scale was the last major reaction, and since then it has continued higher. Well, the next time we get a significant reaction, then if it pulls back below the 700 point level, well, then we might have some clear evidence of more than a short-term peak. When we look at some other companies on these really very impressive trends, then we can similarly see that there is a very consistent sequence of higher reaction lows, so that could clearly signal that it's a consistent trend and that it's a steep trend, but there's nothing really to say that the acceleration has in fact ended. And it's the end of the trend is something that would then start to become a very real factor. Now, it's very easy to identify bubbles. In fact, it's been really quite likely that a bubble would form since quantitative easing was initially introduced, because this massive amount of liquidity, the financial asset price inflation that it engendered, then it would inevitably form a mania in some asset. Well, we have 2 major candidates right now for where the bubbles reside. Most broadly, I would say that it is in the renewable energy sector and then also in the fintech sector. So when we think about Tesla, it has been the poster child for the major bull market. And if we think about the best performing ETFs over the course of 2020, then Cathie Wood has done spectacularly well by becoming the biggest bull in the bull market. And her innovation ETF is heavily weighted to Tesla. So by being the biggest bull of Tesla and having an ETF where Tesla is the largest position, it has been able to be the best performing ETF in the market for all of 2020, which is a really very significant achievement. We also have people that are increasingly bearish, but realistically, nobody pays any attention to the bears until after the fact. Instead, people are much more interested in what the big bulls are doing, and the big bulls are increasingly boosting their expectations for future potential. So having bet that Tesla would go to $4,000, and of course they did have a stock split, so the unsplit value of the share reached $4,000 in here today or yesterday, then the easy thing for the most bullish analyst in a bull market to do is to boost their anticipation of what happens next. Then we can think about what are private equity people doing, because if there is truly a bubble evolving, then I do think that we have to think about where are the epicenters of risk. And the biggest bubble is in the bond markets. Then as we think about, well, what has happened in bond markets over the course of the last 12 years, we've had this massive additional issuance. We've had a massive decrease in interest rates, and that compression of interest rates has forced people out on the risk curve. In many respects, it's like the energy producers going further up a stream to capture cash flows. So instead of investing in listed companies, what private equity investors have done instead is to invest in private companies. We've had successive rounds of of investment in these private companies, and now we're seeing an increasingly large number come up for IPO. When we look at the performance of the IPO ETF, then it's been doing really rather well, and it's hasn't rallied quite as much as the innovation ETF, but it has certainly been doing very well. Now, when something I spent some time today trying to find was a chart of the performance of IPOs. So the bars represent the number of IPOs, and certainly there was a massive boom in the number of IPOs in the 1990s, and it really is only just starting to break out now. But then what really sets the 1990s apart was the first day return on those IPOs, because starting in about 1998, it went wild. And we don't have the same kind of mania yet. So yes, there might be a bubble evolving, but we're not really at the point today where we were in the late 1990s. If anything, this looks more like the beginning of the 1990s. So this isn't the kind of evidence that can point towards an imminent bursting of the bubble. Now, when we think about Tesla, it's a company that is trading on an aggressive valuation. That is nothing new. It's also a company that has been able to raise plenty of cash, so it's going to be able to fund its operations for the foreseeable future. And that's also an indication of the fact that the way that investors are looking at the market today, it's an all or nothing play, because the way that they're investing is they're betting on stellar performance, and what they're risking is a complete erosion of their investment. Because when companies that don't have profits or are heavily dependent on access to liquidity, when they run out of that liquidity, they go bust, and one's investment disappears entirely, and the principal is completely eroded. So when companies are trading on a price to sales ratio in excess of 10, and 10 is already extraordinarily aggressive, and I've put in a really interesting quote from the former CEO of Sun Microsystems, where he was questioning how anybody could ever have paid a price to sales ratio of 10 on his stock in the 1990s. And we are so far beyond that level today that 10 looks almost reasonable. When we look at, for example, Microsoft's stock price, then the share is still in a consistent trend. It rebounded really quite impressively off the lows in here today. It's been in a range for the last while, and it could yet push on to another new high. When we look at the valuation, the price to sales ratio is at 11. So it's at a price to sales ratio higher than Sun Microsystems was when it was at its peak. So we have to at least conclude that, yes, there is potential for additional upside, and this bubble could yet inflate further. And when it eventually runs out of liquidity, well, then some of these highly valued companies are going to come down with a bang. And the ones that don't have earnings, and obviously Microsoft is not one of these, but the ones that do not have positive earnings are going to disappear entirely. So then what happens in terms of interest rates is obviously going to be a very profound decision. The one thing that I think is particularly relevant right now is that the dollar index looks like it is capable of unwinding its short-term oversold condition. The index is right back in the region of the lows from 2018, and this has been a pretty well-defined range over the course of the last 6 years. I do, however, think that when we look at the longer-term chart, well, it gives us more information because the dollar index tends to put in 7 year ranges, or excuse me, 7 year trends up and 7 year trends down. And the last big trend really started in 2011 and generally peaked around the 2017 area. And now the potential is that we're going to trend down to new lows. But it doesn't have to go there in a straight line. So as we look at the short-term oversold condition, with the reticence of the Federal Reserve to get in there and start buying bonds, then what that effectively does is reduces supply of dollars in the very short term. And in the very short term, that suggests that there is scope for a reversion to the mean before the Fed is forced to act. And I do think that that is probably the sequence of events that we're going to see, that we're going to see a significant move in the stock market, and it will subsequently get capped off by the continued move higher in rates. At that point, the dollar will continue to rally both then on a safe haven basis as well as the limited supply basis. It will unwind its oversold condition relative to the trend mean. By which point it's likely that the Federal Reserve will then do what's necessary to control the advance in the yield. And at that stage, the stock market will rebound and the dollar will start to contract again. Now, that's a potential way of thinking about what we can anticipate over perhaps the next 3 months. But over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, it's very likely that the dollar will trend downwards, and that by the time we get out to 2024, 2025, it will be at lows below the low from 2008. So the rest of this bull market on Wall Street is likely to be predicated on nominal price appreciation versus total return on a currency adjusted basis. The big change that we've seen happen in the stock market over our global stock markets over the last 6 months has been that many markets have been able to rally without having to rely on a weak domestic currency. Now, the corollary of thinking about the dollar and the stock market and the bond markets in terms of what the Fed is likely to do at a couple of months out in future is that any meaningful change in the outlook for the supply of dollars, particularly a dearth of dollars, tends to have a negative impact on gold. And it pulled back rather sharply in here today, and it's now right back in the region of the trend mean. And it was off its lows marginally in here today. So now the question remains, is it going to continue to find support in the region of the trend mean? It certainly had a large downside key reversal in here this week, and it's back in the region of the peak from back in 2011. So we're still in a medium-term reaction overall. It still has held the sequence of lower rally highs. It was not able to push on to new rally highs this week. So we're in for a lengthier period of consolidation overall. I think one of the more encouraging factors is that silver has found at least near-term support in the region of $25. There is the potential, at least, that with the scope for more than $1 trillion in additional spending from the new Biden administration, that that may be a factor in, I think, realigning investor interests in a hard asset like gold or silver. But we will definitely need to see evidence of support starting to come through before we have, I think, a real sense of confidence that this corrective phase is in fact over. Obviously, we have to give the benefit of the doubt to these dynamics, but also we have to remain of the view and just remember that precious metals are much more volatile than other instruments. They're a lot smaller and they do tend to whip around a lot more. The big bull trends that we get in gold and silver, and particularly in the bull market up to the peak in 2011, the big portions of advances tend to happen all at once. We get these very, very impressive moves that generally don't last more than about 2 months. And then we go through these very volatile ranging phases, and then we get these very profound advances. Again, the big move up off the lows in March through to the peak in July really only took 4 months. Now, it rallied significantly in that time. But every single one of those accelerations is followed by a meaningful period of ranging where the resolve of investors is very clearly questioned. And if we go back and think about the last bull market, there were very significant advances and they lasted about 8 or 9 months, but they were followed by ranges that lasted for a year and a half. And we had three of those. So when we eventually started to break out and the size of the ranges contracted, but the length of time ranging compressed, well, then we were really in the mania phase. We're just not there yet in terms of gold. We've had a big move to get up to new all-time highs, and it's not at all unusual that a market could go sideways for a lengthy period of time in the region of an all-time peak. Perhaps the clearest evidence of a lengthy range in the region of an all-time peak is the FTSE 100. And it jumped out to a new all-time high in approximately the end of 2016. It ranged for 3 years, broke down, and now it's pushing back up again. But the one thing I want to draw particular attention to is this factor that has completely changed over the course of the last 6 months. If we go back and look at as much history as is relevant over the last 30 years, then we've had very lengthy ranges in the majority of markets outside of the USA from a US dollar perspective. Now, I'm putting in the US dollar for the simple fact that it is the global reserve currency. And a significant number of globally significant asset managers will be looking at their total return in US dollar terms. But it's also a handy metric for looking at relative comparisons. So the FTSE 100 peaked around the 10,000 level in approximately 1998. Briefly broke higher in 2006 and 7, and it's been locked below 10,000 for most of the time since then. Now it's rebounding following Brexit. One of the reasons why the FTSE 100 is doing that is because it is loaded with globally oriented companies. And as the world looks at the potential for reflation, well, then there's clear scope for a very significant move. Now, as we look at these charts, also change the moving average to a 60-month moving average, because that is approximately the 1,000-day moving average. And Now we can think about why hasn't that worked, and let me just change this, because I do think that the 1,000-day moving average is one of the most useful from the perspective of a long-term investor. Obviously, in a long range, the moving average is not useful. But one thing we know that this week is that every time it has got up towards the 1,000-day moving average since 2018, it has failed. If it can sustain the move above 10,000 points on a currency-adjusted basis, well, then we're back in a new bull market. If we then think about how the FTSE 250 has outperformed over that same period of time, it's been ranging below 30,000 since 2014, and the peak in 2007 was also just below those levels. So we can then think that if it can sustain the move up and out to new high ground, well, we're back in a new bull market. The Euro Stoxx index, which is ex-UK, has been also ranging for a really quite profound period of time. And it hasn't really been able to get above this 500-point level for just a brief period in 2006 and 7. If we look at all of Europe, including the non-euro-denominated markets, then we have a very similar story. So Europe generally has just been going sideways for the last 20 years, and it is now right on the cusp of breaking higher. The Nikkei is right on the cusp of pushing a new all-time high from the perspective of a US dollar denominated investor. So the index was up in a dynamic manner in here today. This looks like the end of what is basically a 30-year bear market in Japan, and it has clear scope to outperform over the medium term. The Taiwanese market in the bull market in the late 1980s, it was a high beta play on Japan, and it has already broken higher in US dollar terms. I do also want to highlight that these are all logarithmic scale charts, so what we're seeing are percentage gains overall. The Korean market is also doing exactly the same thing. One thing that has been making headlines the last couple of days has been the fervor of retail investors in Vietnam. And the Vietnamese market is also now pushing back up towards the peaks from back in 2006 and 7. But I think it is interesting that the levels that we've seen finding support now is really quite similar to where the original peaks were all the way back in 2001. We can see the same kind of condition in a large number of Asian markets, where we've had lengthy ranges in the region of previous peaks on a total return basis. So as we think about, well, what is the world going to look like in the next decade? We know that we have got high valuations on Wall Street, and that has helped, that has been, I think, helped by the low interest rate environment, the willingness of governments to spend, the massive amount of debt, the search for yield, the clear demand from institutional investors to capture any kind of return they can to compensate them for the low yield environment. But all of that sits against a background where the majority of emerging markets and global markets overall have not been attractive because Wall Street has been able to hold on to a higher interest rate differential, a stronger currency, and has had outsized growth. Now, they don't have the interest rate differential any longer. The currency looks susceptible to medium-term weakness despite the short-term risk of a rebound. And the ability of the government to handle its issues and sustain a high growth rate is going to be the big question of the next decade. Whereas when we look at the rest of the world, well, the major markets with very strong demographics are India, where the Nifty index is pushing on to new all-time highs on a constant currency basis. The continued ability of China to prosper is also a significant factor, and the CSI 300 is coming up to the upper side of a 13-year range as well. China is now the major heavyweight in the Asian region. So as it continues to exert its influence and remains on a growth trajectory and is coming out of the pandemic overall in a stronger position, then that is acting as a ballast to the growth potential for the region, or it's a stabilizing factor would probably be the best way of thinking about it in terms of growth in the region. We've also seen that there have been significant trade deals that have been signed in the last month, whether that is RCEP, which was ratified in November and is the successor to the Pan-Pacific Partnership. Then we can think about the investment deal that China has signed with Europe, which is clearly beneficial to Germany in particular. The one big question about, or I guess for Europe overall, is what's going to happen in Germany after Angela Merkel is replaced. She has been a stabilizing factor in German politics for an awfully long time, and her immediate successor doesn't seem to be a predictable factor in the short term. So the relative quiet of Europe that we've had for in terms of politics in the major economies could certainly be disrupted over the next few years. But Germany is certainly looking more like it is re-angling growth potential towards Asia and China in particular. The Chinese economy now represents about 8% of all of Germany's exports, and that amount has been trending higher for the last few years. So Germany has to think about how they can sell more into China, and if that means looking past China's record on human rights, well, that's just simply the cost of doing business. The reality from a geopolitical perspective is that countries that are going asking will take what they're given. It's only when they're in a strong position that they can dictate terms. And right now, as China is the fastest growing global economy, our major global economy, it is in the position of being able to dictate terms. Now, obviously, that is going to create some cause of friction out there in the future. But right now, I don't think that there is any major economy is in a position to seriously question or challenge China's ascent. There isn't the political appetite for it, particularly in view of the pandemic. Now, when we think about where the potential lies, well, we can think about the continued bull market in the biotechnology sector. It's a very clear example of a lengthy range being completed, a first step above the base, and then a resumption of the bull market. The entire process of developing a vaccine and then putting it through trials and getting it all done within a year is a massive proof of concept for these new technologies, which have been in development for years. And with proof of concept, they can then go forward and show that these similar technologies can be deployed in a whole range of other scenarios. So it's a really encouraging factor that will help to pioneer inventiveness in biotechnology for the foreseeable future. I did say that it's in fintech that the other significant mania is, because Bitcoin has been by far the best performing asset this decade. And it was briefly above 40,000 in here today. And this represents the first area of potential, the next potential area of resistance. Now, we can think about a number of different factors in terms of Bitcoin. The first, I think, is it's a rather different market to any other in that the original bull market was pioneered by retail investors. And now institutional investors are starting to get more active. So that's the opposite of what we see in other markets. But institutions are definitely getting more interested. Now, the other thing is that it has a really strong history of finding support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. We saw ample evidence of that in the period in 2018, in 2020, also in 2015. We've also seen that it is capable of significant ranges. So every time it pulls back in an aggressive manner and has one of these really very deep pullbacks, then it can range for anything from approximately 18 months out to 3 years. But generally, after a halving event, which occurs about every 4 years, then the market rallies significantly afterwards because of the limited supply argument. Well, the last halving was in May. So now we're seeing this significant breakout. Well, I don't think we can say we've any evidence yet of a pullback. We can also think about the fact that Bitcoin does tend to have these very significant moves. I annotated this chart earlier on this week. Now, pullbacks in the order of 60% are rather rare, but they do occur. But since then, we haven't had a reaction of more than about 20%. We had one of 21%, but not much more than that. And the last one was relatively similar sized in percentage terms. Obviously now, as we look at a price of 40,000, well, a pullback of 20% would be 8,000. So it could easily come back down to the 32,000 point level, and then it would be a potential area of support. 32,000, though, is inside the most recent range. So now the question is, are we going to see a succession of ranges one above another? Because that's what we've certainly seen so far. So that would suggest that we're not quite there yet in terms of the next 20% pullback. And that's assuming that the trend remains consistent. I do think, though, that as we look at the significant advance we've had, particularly since September, up $30,000, well, now we can then think about what happened last time. Because if we go all the way back to the peak in 2017, well, there was clear consistency characteristics in terms of the trend overall. We did have pullbacks in the order of 40%. When it eventually peaked, it was December, and it wasn't just a reflection of the phenomenal bull market that we'd seen, but it also acted as a lead indicator for the stock market. The stock market peaked in early 2018. Everybody tends to think of Bitcoin as an uncorrelated asset, but in fact, that's just not true. The reality is that people have attributed characteristics to the cryptocurrencies that it can basically achieve anything that one wants. It can be the answer to all forms of financial technology questions, or it can be the foundation for all types of contracts. It could be the foundation for all kinds of communication and recording of all communications. But so far, at least, we don't have a lot of evidence to suggest that that's in fact occurring. But instead, what we have is clear evidence that it acts like a lightning rod for speculation. And since that's the case, and because we now have institutional investors becoming more active, well, now what we can then conclude is that the chances are that Bitcoin is going to be a lead indicator for the wider stock market. So when its consistency starts to break down, then that's when we need to pay particular attention to the bull markets in lots of other assets. One thing also that we're going to see in 2021 is an increasingly large number of IPOs, but two are important. One is ByteDance and the other one is Coinbase. Well, ByteDance produces Bitcoin mining machines, and Coinbase is the biggest of the cryptocurrency exchanges. If anyone has to question whether we are entering bubbly conditions, then looking at the price to sales ratio of the CME at 14.5 is really quite interesting, because if we look at the share price, it looks like a recovery candidate. It looks like it's going to continue to rebound from the region of the trend mean. And simply looking at the trend and the chart, there's really not much to worry about. It was up in a dynamic manner in here today, and this looks like a resumption of the medium-term bullish environment overall. But the price-to-sales ratio tells us that it's been doing spectacularly well because of the low interest rate environment, and as a venue for trading, volumes have increased. So everything that happens in terms of financial conditions and the bond markets doesn't happen in isolation. And if bond yields continue to back up, well, then it is going to have a knock-on effect. But I just don't believe that we're at the point yet where the Federal Reserve isn't going to do whatever is necessary to ensure an economic recovery. And one of the ways that the Federal Reserve measures the success of its policies is through the stock market. So either they stop looking at the stock market as a measure of success, or they simply continue the way that they have been going. And with Janet Yellen at the head of the Treasury, and we have a level of cooperation possible, that means that modern monetary theory is the de facto rule now. And it's probably going to be codified at some point in 2021. And at that point, the dollar will continue to trend lower. And the attraction of other assets will continue to be attractive. The fact that the continuous commodity index has now completed a 6-year base formation suggests that commodity demand is going to be a significant factor. If we do in fact get the spending required for a Green New Deal, well, these extraordinary moves in the renewable energy sector will perhaps continue to advance. Because so far, all it looks like is a completion of the base formation. And thinking that this trend is over when it has really only just begun, I think would be a mistake. When we then think about the base formation completion in the wind sector, it's really only happened this year. So these look like the beginnings of new trends. The breakouts on global markets in constant currency terms look like the beginnings of new trends, whereas the massive valuations that are attached to technology companies look like the ends of trends. So we're at the point where there is a very significant rotation going on. The dollar is the linchpin of that rotation. So we're seeing the potential in the short term for a reversionary rally, but it's very hard to imagine that we're going to see more than that in the short term. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.